to my astounding family and friends near and far, old and new. This is Kevin Mercurio on the mic, and welcome to the 15th episode of the Metaforigens podcast. Just to reiterate the new things happening this season, one thing is the Metaforigens merch. If you would like your own shirt and or mug, as shown on the Metaforigens Instagram page, just shoot me a message on my website or Instagram account. Any profits I make each month will go towards a local charity, example the SPCA, Ottawa Regional Cancer Foundation, and other suggestions. Another feature I will have this season is Request. Starting on the next episode, some will be dedicated to any expressions listeners of this podcast would like me to cover, including the creative intro story. For a request, please shoot me a message on, again, my website or Instagram. Now, to show support if you like this sort of content, please make sure to rate and subscribe to the podcast on Apple or whatever platform you're listening to this on, and follow at Metaforigens on Instagram, that's at Metaforigens, where I'll be posting most of my updates as well as on my personal website, kjbmercurio.com/Metaforigens. Regular listeners of this podcast will know that I hold a draw every 5 episodes, for now anyway, and so I will be giving away yet another awesome Metaforigens shirt to one lucky listener right now. I have done the draw for the butterfly printed Metaforigens shirt, and the winner is Andrew Cam. Wow! Congratulations. I'll shoot you a message following this episode. Okay. In today's episode, I'll be stepping back from metaphorical language and talk about something that people are beginning to get familiar with due to the current state of the world. I touched on it briefly on my 10th episode about scientific literature, and because it is quite a significant subject, I believe it requires an episode all on its own. And that topic is peer review. Oh, peer review. How many times have you heard that concept uttered in your career? I guess that question is mainly to my fellow scientists. The importance of peer review. How peer review has revolutionized the dissemination of knowledge. Hey, my paper has been accepted after passing peer review. No revisions required. If only that were the case, eh? But to others in different professions, does peer review conjure feelings of trust? Does peer-reviewed work mean factual knowledge to you? I mean, why would it not? Theories criticized and challenged by experts in the field to fine-tune hypotheses and experiments, cutting down towards the ultimate truth of nature and reality. Sounds good to me. Now, if we remember from my previous episode, scientific literature is what academics, mainstream media, and the general public consider as fact. While these scholarly publications undergo academic publishing, which requires a systematic review of the work, or what we call peer review. Elsevier, one of the leading giants of academic publishing, says that, quote, the peer review system exists to validate academic work, helps improve the quality of published research, and increases networking possibilities within research communities. Is that true? Let's dissect that statement a little bit, as there's a lot to unpack there. The system they are speaking of, paraphrased in my previous episode, consists of an 11-plus step process from author submission of a manuscript or the unformatted form of their work to acceptance. Yes, there can be, and generally are, more steps to this, as often authors are asked to perform various revisions regarding more experiments, consideration of other hypotheses, clarity in data interpretations, etc., etc. This system validates academic work in a way that journals can be satisfied with the papers they decide to publish, since the work has been checked by experts in the field, and thus improving the quality of published research as a whole. So those parts seem valid. However, increasing networking opportunities would be difficult, seeing as authors normally don't know which experts are reviewing them in the most common form of peer review. More on types of peer review later. Perhaps reviewers can be aware of other experts in their field and establish communication with them for potential collaboration. More on how this can actually be a problem. In addition, I wonder how much that actually happens. Peer review is one of those concepts that sound great in theory. A system made by researchers and put in place relatively recently with the right intentions. Though I think a problem scientists have is that we don't truly think about the logistics of the peer review system. It's not as simple and clear-cut as many researchers think, especially for young up-and-coming scientists, too busy trying to crank out paper after paper, staying up late to finish experiments, and analyze the observations jotted quickly in lab notebooks. In a blog post in Cell Press, Vice President of Editorial Dr. Deborah Sweet mentions that, quote, younger scientists in particular often talk about the peer review process as being a mysterious black box that they simply don't understand. This is very, very true. And yes, I know there are no degrees of truth. The one thing I'm sure younger researchers are aware of is the meme of douchebag reviewer number two, happily highlighting 80% of the paper in red as if drunk off some sort of scholarly, reviewer-brewed cold-press coffee. There's even a Twitter account dedicated to such harsh comments, though the account is unfortunately named reviewer number three. Like, come on, editor at Journal X, why can't you start with the bad news and finish off with the good, critical but fair review? The point here is not to question whether the implementation of peer review should exist or not. In a 2008 large-scale international survey conducted by the Peer Review Consortium, out of 3,040 academics, 85% agreed that peer review greatly helps scientific communication, and 83% believed that without peer review, there would be no control, assumingly of the quality of work being published. Still a majority, but this statistic drops down to 64% of academics when asked if they are satisfied with the current system of peer review used by journals, and drops even further to 32% when asked if they believe that this current system is the best possible. And that's the thing. Are academics, especially those just beginning to establish their careers, even aware that there are different journals having different types of peer review systems? Are academics aware of the flaws and biases inherent within the most commonly used peer review systems? Are academics in tune with the pros and cons of keeping peer review as it is, or know of the movement for abolishing it entirely for a completely new way of disseminating scientific work? What about new journals and publishing companies trying to revolutionize this concept and compete against giants who are currently dominating the business, yes, business, of publishing science? That's what this episode will attempt to elaborate on. I will start with the history of peer review, introduce the different types of peer review systems, and the various movements in changing the current general system. You might be surprised to just how complex this simple concept can get. My goal will be to highlight the gap in knowledge researchers have in what the peer review process actually is, and for the public to better understand how interpretations of scientific work become good enough to be fact. Peer review, best described by Brian Campbell in his blog on xordo.com, quote, is like democracy. The saying goes, despite its flaws, it's the best system we have. So let's understand it. Most of this information was obtained from many articles discussing the advantages and disadvantages of peer review systems, from fellow researchers to those in executive positions of academic publishing organizations. All sources will be mentioned in the description. Let's start with the interesting fact that peer reviewing scholarly work prior to dissemination to the masses was not always the case. And in fact, its initial purpose was not for the notion of improving the quality of the work, nor to ensure the validity of the work in question. In a 2014 review of peer review, funny enough, from the Journal of International Federation of Clinical Chemistry and Laboratory Medicine, Kelly and colleagues state, quote, the peer review process was first described by a Syrian physician named Ishaq bin Ali al-Rawi, who lived from year 854 to 931, in his book Ethics of the Physician. Paraphrasing the description, physicians were required to take notes describing the state of their patients' medical conditions upon each visit, and notes were scrutinized by local medical professionals as to whether the physician met the standard of medical care. Interesting, since you can imagine that falsifying data would have been incentivized. Yet it wasn't until after the invention of the printing press and the formation of journals and societies to publish scientific work in some form of a catalog did the philosophical transactions of the Royal Society formalize the peer review process. This process was introduced to, quote, help editors decide which manuscripts to publish in their journals, likely as a method of choosing work that would boost readership. Peer review developed as scientific research became more abundant, fine-tuned by prestigious academic societies in the 18th century to finally validate the findings in manuscripts by experts to the system we have in modern day. Peer review has become a standard for determining the credibility of work, but also the credibility of publishers that disseminate said work. Theories and interpretations of experimental data are not accepted unless it has been published in a peer-reviewed journal. In fact, according to Kelly and colleagues, quote, the Institute for Scientific Information, ISI, only considers journals that are peer-reviewed as candidates to receive impact factors. Defined by Thomson Scientific, quote, the journal impact factor is the average number of times articles from the journal published in the past 2 years have been cited, a metric commonly used to determine which journals churn out the most defined and original work. This doesn't always hold true, but scientific journals and their massive publishing organizations are another big topic that deserve their own episode in the future. Thus, and do correct me if I'm wrong, but the way in which peer review is currently run has not been heavily debated until fairly recently. Perhaps it was long regarded as a crappy but necessary process in academia. Hell, the topic has surprisingly been picked up by mainstream news sites like Vox, who in 2016 published an article titled, "This New Study May Explain Why Peer Review in Science Often Fails." In it, they reference a study published in PLOS One in which researchers using mathematical modeling showed how there is, quote, a small minority of researchers shouldering most of the burden of peer review, at least those that were indexed in Medline for biomedical research. This striking finding calls to question why peer review is not more uniformly distributed. It also calls to question whether peer review actually works to achieve what it currently is set out to achieve, pointed out by the former editor of the journal BMJ, Dr. Richard Smith, saying, quote, we have little or no evidence that peer review works, but we have lots of evidence of its downside. Let's not get too ahead of ourselves and continue with the basics. How does one even participate in peer review? Wiley, another publishing giant, states steps in which one can be invited to review a manuscript. As, quote, there is no one way to become a reviewer, but there are some common routes. These include, 1, asking a colleague who already reviews for a journal to recommend you, 2, networking with editors at a professional conference, 3, becoming a member of a learned society and then networking with other members in your area, 4, contacting journals directly to inquire if they are seeking new reviewers, 5, seeking mentorship from senior colleagues, and 6, working for senior researchers who may then delegate peer review duties to you. Or in other words, networking, networking, networking. This aligns with Elsevier's quote earlier. There is no application process, and it seems rare for journal editors to outright contact you for your expertise based on the work you do. Reviewers essentially want to review. So what makes researchers review their peers' work? Perhaps it's the compensation they get for evaluating the work of their colleagues. Maybe it's the recognition for their contributions of validating work done in their field. Or it could be that peer review is just part of being an academic, and therefore if you want to be a part of this community, it just happens to be a task you are expected to perform. Unfortunately, only one of those is correct, and that opinion might even be dependent on who you ask. Researchers doing peer review are not paid extra for the time they invest in evaluating the colleague's work, nor are they even recognized for the feedback, good or bad, that they provide to manuscript authors. No, and I've tried to find another possible answer, but it seems that peer review can be juxtaposed to the academic's pro bono case. With this in mind, you can imagine that motivation for reviewing work, work that the majority of people will consider as fact, can be rather minimal. I mean, researchers need to focus on their own work, running their own labs, keeping up to date with their employees, apply for government or institutional funding, and the like. Peer review would certainly be at the bottom of their list of priorities, if a priority at all. Are there hidden incentives that drive encouragement to peer review? In a 2018 article published in the International Journal of Surgery Oncology, Koshy and colleagues state that there are several incentives to participating in peer review. The majority of these are exactly as mentioned before, to benefit your discipline, to structure sound government policies, and what I think is the best, quote, working as a peer reviewer carries a level of prestige that can be used in one's credentials. The problem is that others don't know whether your reviews are good or bad, not in terms of the overall impression of the work, but in terms of the content of your feedback. The only incentives that I can see on their list are 1, awareness of the field, 2, training for critical analysis of research, and potentially 3, peer reviewer recognition and bonuses. The third, obviously sounding great, must be uncommon, as it's generally known that reviewers are not compensated or recognized for the reviews they conduct. Also, reviewers do have deadlines to submit their reviews back to journal editors. Therefore, a voluntary task with deadlines and no immediate incentives to ensure a decent amount of effort put into evaluating peer work seems like a system that needs to be adjusted. Let's go into what I believe are the 5 main types of peer review. I mentioned this back in my previous episode, but I skipped the less common ones. We'll start with the most used form, single-blinded peer review, in which reviewers are aware of the author's identities, but not vice versa. A double-blinded peer review would be the case that authors and reviewers' identities are not known to one another. And you bet your butt that there's also triple-blinded peer review as well, in which not only do the authors and reviewers not know each other, but neither does the editor. Now, we're just missing the quadruple and quintuple blinded peer review, in which the computers and the quantum particles also don't know who's who, types in which I've coined myself as dark peer review. When you don't understand something, just put dark in front of the closest thing it resembles. Okay, there's also, of course, open peer review, in which everyone knows everyone, post-publication peer review, in which manuscripts are published after being screened for their fit towards the specific journal, and then reviewed by the scientific community at large, and lastly, preprint peer reviews, an interesting topic in its own right, where publications that progress to single, double, triple-blinded peer review can be uploaded onto a preprint server and then also reviewed by the scientific community at large. Outside of these 5, there's also collaborative peer review, where reviewers can work together to produce 1 peer review report, and interactive peer review, in which reviewers provide feedback to the authors as they review the work, leading to suggestions and corrections happening in real time, and concluding with a final version of the manuscript that the editor can publish. All forms of peer review can take a month or multiple months to complete. Again, single-blinded peer reviews are the most common type. The anonymity for the reviewers has been stated as very important, as it, quote, allows the reviewer to be honest without fear of criticism from an author. This is typically important for younger researchers who want to establish a name for themselves in their fields and don't want any blowback from scientific juggernauts with lots of influence. You can easily understand already why that is a problem. Why should fellow researchers have to think twice regarding their opinions about someone else's work? That doesn't illustrate the friendly scientific community the public thinks is the case, right? Is the scientific community open and friendly? The best possible answer I can probably say, based on my own experience as a male from a first world country, yes at an individual level, no at an institutional level. The publishing giant Wiley even acknowledges this in its own critique of the single-blinded peer review system, in which, quote, knowledge of the author may overshadow the quality of the work, potentially leading to a lack of scrutiny, and, quote, there is the potential for discrimination based on gender or nationality. In addition, single-blinded peer review might incentivize reviewers to stall, especially if the work in question is similar to their own work. Honestly, wouldn't you want your own work to be remembered versus some competing lab? Should scientists be even competing with each other? That is literally the case right now. Google being scooped in academia for more on this. What about double-blinded peer review? Surely this would be a better system. In fact, a 2008 large-scale international survey done by the PRC highlighted that 56% of respondents preferred this type of system. Both Wiley and its competitor Elsevier state that this type should reduce bias towards authors. However, it's often noted that despite the anonymity, reviewers can often discover the identity of the authors, or at least which lab the work comes from, based on the writing and self-citation, done frequently as work is often branched off of other work done in the same lab. This defeats the purpose of double-blinded peer review and the extra administrative work required to do so. Others have argued that, quote, knowledge of the author's identity helps the reviewer come to a more informed judgment, and that without this, the review suffers. This potentially has merit, since if double-blinded peer review is done properly, work done previously by the authors may be hidden from reviewers, work that may help reviewers better understand where the field stands. I won't go too much into triple-blinded peer review, as it is quite rare. It is argued that this may in fact be the only way to reduce as much bias as possible, but it seems like overkill. The complexity of conducting a thorough review of this kind would be slow and counterproductive. As well, this doesn't solve previous problems seen in double-blinded peer reviews with the loss of author anonymity. We arrive at the more recently developed types of systems. Open peer review is one of the newest, but picking up speed in the academic publishing community. In fact, a minority of journals may also publish these reviews along with the paper, ensuring that all parts of the process are transparent. These systems, in addition to transparency, encourages well-thought-out feedback, possibly increasing the quality of the work in question. Despite these benefits, reviewers may hold back negative comments in fear of reprisals from the authors, particularly if there is an imbalance of power or influence. Reviewers are also known to refuse open peer review requests altogether if their identity has to be known for the same reason. Obviously, this should not be a problem in the scientific community, but it is. Otherwise, this would certainly be the best way to ensure honesty and full cooperation in disseminating high-quality research. Perhaps post-publication is the way to go. In an episode of his podcast, The Portal, outspoken physicist and managing director of the investment firm Thiel Capital, Dr. Eric Weinstein, calls peer review, quote, a cancer from outer space. It came from the biomedical community, it invaded science. People who are now professional scientists have an idea that peer review has always been in our literature, and it absolutely motherfucking has not. This great quote might make him seem like a peer review abolisher. However, what he desires is the post-publication system, where authors pass the traditional, quote, peer injunction and progress into the real peer review, once it has been published in a journal, after editor read-through and scrutiny. Thus, true peer review can occur, since the entire community is open to providing their feedback. Now, there is obvious problems with this system as well. This is a lot of power for one or a select number of associate editors for a journal to have. Perhaps we imagine that this system, if accepted by the highest level journals, would impact the number of papers published either by increasing or decreasing this number. Increasing would certainly mean more low quality work would be disseminated and perhaps misinterpreted by mainstream media, the general public, or even other researchers. Decreasing would mean that a lot of researchers, often graduate students or postdocs, would have even more trouble adding accepted publications to their resume, impacting their career opportunities and government funding, since the current standard for scientific success is the amount of scientific literature you produce. In another review published this year in the British Journal of Philosophical Science, authors Heeson and Bright call for the embrace of post-publication peer review as well, stating that perhaps journals could still publish relevant work and have their exclusive editions contain only the work that passes the scrutiny of the scientific community at large. It's a conundrum for sure. Preprint peer reviews are another way of combining this method with the general system of blinded peer reviews already in place, but it doesn't answer the overall question of at what point should scientific work be shared with the community. Should we keep the current system and be aware of the biases and flaws inherent in it? We already know that biases towards nationalities and sexes occur, and that the systems have slow turnover and high effort dedication. Should all work be shared and thus have more work retracted due to post-pub open review? We already know that, excluding the potential for low-quality work to slip through the cracks and be misinterpreted by people, that researchers require publications as a metric to succeed in academia. It's complicated, right? The fact of the matter is, we need expert opinions to weigh in on the conclusions derived from scientific research and how those conclusions were formed. Perhaps the current system as it stands now is flawed, but is the best system that the scientific community has. In my opinion, and I don't think I can get fully into it in this episode, is that there lies two major problems. The first is the reluctance of researchers to be fully honest in their reviews if their identities become known, fearing backlash from authors and perhaps even other researchers who disagree with their opinions. This, despite the system, should never occur, in order for the human race to progress our knowledge of how the universe works effectively. The second problem is the concept that scientific achievement is measured based on the number of your publications that pass peer review. Now wait, I understand that this makes a lot of sense, as it means that you are producing good quality work in an efficient manner, so obviously you're doing something right. But if peer review, in its current form, can be biased towards race, sex, even previous work, and requires a lot of voluntary time from experts to properly review the material, should this be the main factor of government funding for your lab? Should experts even conduct thorough reviews if considering publishing others' work should prioritize publishing their own work? These are all fair questions that none of these systems have an answer for. I didn't have much time to go through new journals and technologies trying to revolutionize the publishing space, like F1000 Research, PeerJ, and Rubrik, though links to learn more about them will be in the description. The important takeaway here is to be aware of what peer review actually means. These various validation systems are processes that scientific literature goes through prior to being published. And perhaps by discussing it in detail through science communication means, like the annual ASAP Bio HHMI meeting for academic publishers, or even in this small podcast, we can create a peer review system that incentivizes thorough, honest evaluation and reduce as much bias as possible. This would not only demonstrate the inclusivity of what science strives to be, but leads our collective knowledge that much closer to the universal truths governing us all. For this episode, I would like to try something a bit different. What I want is for this podcast to slowly grow into a platform for academics to come on and give their opinion about communicating science, whether you're an established researcher or graduate student. In particular, I think trainees are usually hidden from the public eye, yet they do a substantial amount of work to get scientific work available to other researchers and the public via publishing means. With that said, I will be doing my first interview today with someone who I believe is doing great work in the SciComm community. She's a recent graduate from the University of Alberta, finishing her Master's of Science in Chemical Engineering with a focus on bacterial viruses. Before this, she completed her Bachelor's of Science in Cell Biology. She now works for Genome Alberta, but she briefly worked in recruitment for AbCellera and has spent the past few years working and volunteering in the realm of science communications and outreach. Presently, she writes for the Science Writers and Communicators of Canada blog and sits as the steering committee chair for Science Slam Canada. She has been a mentor and longtime volunteer for WISIS and recently founded the female-focused networking group SOAR. Please welcome the wonderfully talented Miranda Stahn. Thank you, Miranda, for doing this interview for my podcast. You are my first interview, so this is going to be interesting. We're going to try the Skype method and see how that goes. So for the people that are listening, I know Miranda since, I believe, summer of 2014. We both worked in Dr. Dominique Sauvageau's lab, who's like one of the all-time favorite mentors I've ever had. He was I believe it's chemical engineering, but the lab mainly focused on viruses, bacteriophages in particular. So Miranda's from the University of Alberta, and she is involved in a lot of SciComm extracurricular activities.
So I'm just going to give her some time just to, you know, tell them about your experience in science. So through your master's, through your undergrad, and then we'll talk about some of the stuff you're doing now.
Yeah, sounds great. I can't believe that was 6 years ago.
Crazy.
Oh my gosh. So I did my bachelor's of science in cell biology. So it was a very medically focused degree. But I always had an interest in engineering as well as more the industrial applications of biology. So that's what drew me to Dr. Savinger's work. And after finishing my undergrad, I spent a small stint researching in psychiatry, doing drug development for Alzheimer's disease, but eventually went back to Dr. Savinger to do my master's in chemical engineering, which is really weird for a biologist to say, where I focused on bacterial viruses and kind of bringing together some of Dominic's research in another very niche field of methanotroph biology. So methanotrophs are bacteria that will convert single carbon compounds such as methane into really cool byproducts such as isoprenoids for jet fuel or PHB to make bioplastics. And I was studying bacteriophage in the context of these microbes because it hadn't been done since the 1970s in Soviet Russia. So there were two papers on bacterial viruses in these strains, and pretty much all the data was lost when the USSR fell. So it was kind of interest, but just a real that I've been touched for over 30 years. So.
I didn't actually know you went back to Dr. Savinger's lab. I thought you went to a different lab.
Yeah, I dabbled around for a bit. I actually started my master's in psychiatry, but then transferred over to chemical engineering by a series of really crazy events. it's one of those academic stories.
Right. It's cool, though. I didn't know he also did a methanotrope work. Mm-hmm. So that used bacteriophages to kind of manipulate the specific bacteria that you were working with?
We were simply just trying to identify phages that could infect methanotrophs.
Oh, I see.
We mainly ended up inducing lysogens, which is really essential when you think about the fact they want to scale up this technology into batch fermenters to make large amounts of PHB. If a phage system gets into any sort of fermentation, you could lose your whole batch. So the fact that no one even thought of looking at phages before scaling up kind of floored me, because in the dairy industry, they've been well characterized. So.
Okay, cool. No, that's really interesting stuff. And you also do a lot of like outside academia work. So I just wrote down a couple of things. I saw that part of your Twitter page. You're the founder of an organization called SOAR. You're also involved in the Science Networkers and also run your own conferences. Maybe you can just talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, for sure. So SOAR was kind of my first outside of academic baby that I came up with. And what it does is the goal of the organization is to put early career women in touch with potential mentors who are established in their career, as well as help them just, I guess, develop key skills for careers and the development of their jobs, because women will naturally face different hurdles than men when entering the tech sector or the biotech industry.
Mm-hmm.
So what we do is, through workshops and networking events, help people develop skills like how to reach out to people on LinkedIn or how to ace a job interview, and really empowering them by giving them information on what's acceptable and what's not acceptable and how to avoid bias. And it's just a great network of women in both the business and tech sector. We started as an Edmonton-focused organization, but then because of COVID, it was really cool. We were able to move online and have now garnered a national audience, which is fantastic.
Nice.
And then Science Networkers was actually just born a couple of weeks ago, and it might be of more interest to your listeners because it is a networking group for science communicators. And we run panels and discussions with established communicators and give people the opportunity to make connections, start collaborations, and just learn more about breaking into the career of SciComm, whether they want to do it professionally full-time or look more at freelancing part-time through their PhD or while working mm-hmm. in a different field.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, it's really cool stuff. And I know that some of my listeners are also looking into doing science communication work, either as part of their PhD or master's. Some are even contemplating doing it as full-time work. And there's a lot of, I guess, not a lot of information on how to kind of profit or get income off of doing stuff like this. So I think these sorts of initiatives are really important for just to get the information out there.
Yeah, no, for sure. It's definitely a feat, and you have to be very passionate and get involved in passion projects, but you never know where something like that's going to lead. So it's always great to hear from someone who's done it successfully. It kind of gives people a bit more motivation to go forward.
Definitely, definitely. Okay, so that's a good intro. So this specific episode that I'm doing for my podcast is on peer review. And why I chose peer review is that there's a lot of steps in the process of science that not only the public doesn't know about, but I think some academics don't even know about.
Yeah.
I did an episode on exactly what scientific literature is. That was in my previous season of this podcast. That was mainly for my general audience who are interested in science but don't exactly know, you know, what makes the research be defined as scientific literature. Where do we get facts from? And I think that's important because, you know, there's a lot of misinformation out there, especially in today's times, through social media. A lot of people are making these claims that aren't cited, aren't referenced to specific documents, which we would define as scientific literature. And this scientific literature undergoes a process called peer review. And this is where we get kind of the facts from. So this is what this episode is about. I talked a lot about, you know, what peer review, the different types of peer review. I talked about what sort of steps people take or academics take to become a reviewer. So I was wondering if you had any experience with peer review, either being a part of submitting a manuscript for peer review or conducting a peer review in the past. Have you ever been involved in this sort of process?
Yeah, I've been fortunate enough to be on kind of either side of things. I've both experienced peer review in submitting my own manuscripts and have been on the other side reviewing papers and providing feedback. So, I've been fortunate to kind of see both sides of the story.
Okay, I'll pick apart that. So, for example, being a part of submitting a manuscript, this was to, I guess, a scientific journal. Based on some work that you've done?
Yes, yeah.
Cool. So do you know what sort of type of peer review that was? Was it a single-blinded peer review in which you didn't know who the reviewers were, but they knew who you were, double-blinded, open peer review? Do you know the type of it?
It was single-blind.
Single-blind.
Yeah, and with that came some frustrations.
Definitely. And a lot of information out there. A lot of surveys are even out there that kind of talk about, you know, what are the flaws single-blinded peer review has. From your standpoint, before I continue, what sort of problems did you face when you underwent single-blinded peer review?
So this was for some work I did before my formal master's degree, and it came down to a beef between the professor who was submitting on the paper and one of the reviewers, because the reviewer obviously knew who he was and was being more difficult than necessary because of a previous discrepancy the two had, which just made it frustrating for us to get this paper out. Kind of delayed the process a bit more than should have been expected.
Right. Yeah, that's definitely a problem. You know, when there's disagreements or when there's just outside of the workplace sort of drama. And that's a problem, I think, that a lot of academics don't really think about. There's definitely some inherent biases that people have, especially if there's competing labs that, you know, have disagreements in the sort of theories that they're trying to get out there to publicize. So in that case, do you think like a double-blinded peer review would have improved the process of your manuscript submission?
For that particular manuscript, yeah, I think it would have. But on the flip side, if you're working in really niche fields, say something like methanotroph biology or even phage research is still pretty small. Often, even with double-blind studies, you can kind of figure out who the paper is coming from and what lab may be coming from based on the theme or the phrasing or the context in which the research is produced. So I think in larger fields, like the one where we were having issues with a single blind study, it would have helped because Alzheimer's research is very, very saturated. There's a lot of different people working on similar things.
Right.
However, in smaller fields, I don't necessarily know it would remove some of the problems with single blind studies.
That's true. And a flaw with double blinded peer review, for example, is that exactly like you said, how reviewers can still kind of know who the work is coming from based on their writing, based on their self-citation, because a lot of the times you are referencing your own lab's work. So it's important to have those sorts of introduction information in the manuscript, just so the reviewer kind of knows where this work is coming from. But then again, you are removing that anonymity from the author.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So what sort of peer review have you conducted yourself? So we talked about submitting you submitted a manuscript, you were involved in single-blinded peer review. You said you had some experience also reviewing scientific work?
Yeah, so I was a reviewer for an undergraduate journal at the U of A, which does the exact same process, just lower impact, but it gives undergrads a chance to kind of go through the review process before hitting grad school. So there I was part of a double-blind review, and I really did appreciate that method, and it helped me stay unbiased. And then I've done, or I guess assisted in more collaborative peer review during my master's. And I found that to be a really interesting way to conduct review in the scientific realm. It kind of felt more like the 16th century Italian saloons where people would go discuss ideas, discuss science, discuss philosophy. And even though I guess nothing was anonymous, it really created interesting discussions, and I felt maybe took the papers into realms of new creativity that they wouldn't have reached before.
Mm-hmm. So just for the folks that are listening, collaborative peer review, is that in your case, that was when you and the author were kind of talking with one another as you were reviewing the work?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So that's kind of like real-time suggestions, back and forth communication, so that to me, it seems like it'd be a more efficient process and, you know, having a final product that could be provided to the public.
Yeah, 100%. And you know what? It might not work in all scenarios, and it might very much depend on the personalities of the reviewer and the submitter, but I definitely feel there's a place for it in the scientific community that's undervalued.
Mm-hmm. What are your thoughts on... So, we talked about single-blinded, double-blinded, a bit about open and collaborative peer review. What are your thoughts on, like, post-publication peer review? There is some movement out there, some prominent scientists who are pushing for this sort of, this type of peer review in which a journal, you know, you can still submit a manuscript to a journal. The editor of that journal can decide, you know, whether this is good enough to be, or not good enough, but interesting enough, well thought out enough to be given to the scientific community. And then the entire scientific community has the chance to scrutinize it, criticize it, comment on it. Do you have any thoughts on this sort of type of peer review?
I like it personally. I think it opens again the discussion for further research and kind of that old like Grecian style of talking about things. I do think we need to be cautious because it could very easily just become a firing range against certain researchers.
Mm-hmm. True.
So I think that comes down to more, I guess, the goodness of people. And my concern with it is just so many scientific ideas get pushed aside because they're disliked or they're too new or people don't want to change their thinking. And I think if people in the scientific community aren't going to be open-minded, that post-publication review could become a very toxic environment. But at the same time, people definitely seem to be more progressive these days. But I just think back to the discovery of dinosaurs and how societally no one wanted that to be right. And no one wanted Darwin mm-hmm. to be right, but he very much was. So I definitely think there's a place for it. It'll be interesting to see how it evolves, especially with so many researchers wanting to be interdisciplinary, wanting to be engaged in different facets of science. I think it could provide tons of perspectives from other fields and new ideas. So.
Yeah, definitely. I agree with all those points. What I picture, you know, post-publication peer review is kind of like, it's kind of like a Twitter, but you're kind of only allowing people with credit to make comments.
Yeah.
I think that seems to be that seems to me like a really interesting method of improving the, I guess, the work that is being put out there. Obviously,
yeah.
the journal editor would be in charge of, you know, if this work is relevant to the specific topic of the journal, if the work, if the experiments and the thought process of interpreting the data is, you know, sound based on mm-hmm. their own expertise. But I think it would be nice to have as many comments and opinions from credible people to, you know, feel free to open, you know, feel free to review the work and have all sorts of different perspectives in terms of what the author could improve on, what the author got right, what the author got wrong. And that should, to me, it should only improve the work that is selected by the journal editor.
And when you consider the post-COVID world we live in, where conferences are either virtual or have just been canceled, I think it could help us definitely push research forward in a time when we can't physically gather in rooms and discuss new collaborations and new ideas or ways to improve our work. So definitely
yeah.
a place for it nowadays.
Mm-hmm. And also because, you know, I said this in the previous part of this episode, where, you know, reviewers aren't compensated for this extra work that they're doing, or they're not really recognized other than the fact that they say that they're a reviewer for this journal, for the review, the peer review that they conduct. So if it is open to, you know, everyone to do peer review, I think it'd encourage people to do it, even though they're not compensated, even though there's no incentives to do mm-hmm. this work diligently.
No, I agree. Even if you look at like academic Twitter or the more science boards of Reddit, people obviously want to have conversations about their research and engage other researchers, and it would give them a way to do that more formally and obviously with some sort of filter provided by the publication itself. So
mm-hmm. Do you think there should be incentives for academics to do peer review? Even doesn't have to be compensation; it could be other things, just to so that, you know, they're encouraged to do it thoroughly and properly.
Definitely. Like if you would have asked me that a few years ago, I would have been like, "No, you wanted to be a professor; that's part of the gig." But till I really started reviewing papers on my own and going through things with a fine-tooth comb, I really didn't understand the diligence and commitment it takes to be a good reviewer. No one wants to be the horrible reviewer number two or something like that.
Yeah.
So what that compensation would be, I have no idea. I don't think it should be monetary, but definitely I think people undervalue how long it takes to provide a cohesive and meaningful review to someone's work.
Yeah. And so I read some studies. They'll be referenced in the reference section of this episode, but there was a study that said the majority of peer review is shouldered by a small percentage of the academics that are capable of doing the peer review. And a lot of these academics who are conducting peer review say on average they do, you know, it takes a lot of hours to conduct a thorough peer review. Sometimes it takes, you know, 100 hours. Sometimes it takes more, sometimes less. But it is a substantial amount of time that academics have to, you know, set aside so that they can review their colleagues' work, make sure they're doing it properly, and make sure that the science and overall the theories and the facts that we're getting from are correct.
Yeah, I agree. And if you look in other fields and comparable professions, editors get paid for their work, and it's really no different. It's obviously a different style of review, but they're very much providing feedback and making sure something's coherent and matching whatever their publication or whatever newspaper they're working for's message. Not as labor intensive, but they're definitely credited for that work. So the fact that academics aren't, I think, comes into some bigger biases within the profession of being a career academic or professor.
Right, definitely. In terms of biases, I didn't cover that too much in my episode, mainly because I feel like I'm not fit to kind of go into the biases based on, you know, who I am. If you have comments, you don't have to talk about this, but if you have some comments on any sort of inherent biases in the peer review process in terms of, you know, knowing the identity of authors and perhaps what, you know, is prevalent now or at least publicized in public now in terms of the biases towards women, in terms of the biases towards race. Do you have any comments on any biases found in this sort of process of peer review?
Like, a lot of what I've experienced has more been through hearsay or kind of at the fringes of my network, because myself, I'm still a very young researcher, but one of my mentors faced significant biases in trying to get her publications out simply because she was a woman in STEM, and she was quite early in STEM, and she quite often would just receive rejections that she felt either over critiques, people would just be way too harsh on her publications versus say if a male counterpart submitted the same paper. And she felt there was an inherent bias towards women in STEM and academia, and that came out in her trying to publish. So I think it comes down to having a bit of a tough skin. I definitely feel, at least for women in STEM, things are getting better. They're not perfect. And it's really field dependent. Obviously, female researchers in psychology will have a lot easier time trying to publish than, say, women in physics, where very much they are still a minority. So it's hard to say. It's very field specific. Women in medicine and biotech are about a 50-50 rate, I think, the last time I checked the stats. So it's not as bad, but I think you'll start to see these things tease out as more women hold higher roles in institutions and more women are simply put into academia. There will obviously be more female reviewers available. As for bias towards researchers of color or researchers who identify as majorities or LGBTQ, I can't speak on that, but I've definitely heard that there are biases out there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's quite wild.
Yeah, it's crazy. You'd like to think that people just make it about the science, but there's so much politics in academia.
Yeah, and I don't think the public really knows that. I think the public thinks, and I said this in my episode, that the public is thinking that, you know, scientific community is quite friendly, quite open, but in fact there's definitely some bias there for sure.
Yeah, 100%.
So I'll just go into the last couple questions here, and I think we kind of covered it, but like in your opinion, you might have said this is based on the circumstances, but do you think that there's the best type of peer review out there? Do you think that there's a specific peer review type that most journals, if not all, should adopt? And do you think that there should be a worse type of peer review out there?
Like, I'm always leaning towards double blind because idealistically, it removes a lot of the biases we were just talking about. But then again, it's important to acknowledge that it might not be as foolproof for some fields as others. But there's definitely something to be said for the process of a double-blind review. And then as for, like, I'm not a fan of open review or single-blind. I feel there's just too much bias there. And mm-hmm. that might just come from the field I work in, where it is very niche. But I definitely think there's a better way of doing things. and then in an idealistic world, I'd love to see everything be either a collaboration or some sort of post-publication discussion, but I'm not sure if the scientific community is there yet, but I think there's potential for it to end up there.
Mm-hmm. No, I agree with all that for sure. Yeah, I think that covers it. I think this discussion actually lasted much longer than I thought. So it's good that we had a lot to talk about. Do you have any final thoughts to say? And perhaps you can even do some self-promotion if you like, your Twitter handles and Instagram handles, stuff like that.
Yeah, for sure. No, I think having discussions about things like peer review that have been so almost established in the academic community is needed because as society changes, as we change culturally, this is definitely something we're going to have to look at. In particular to removing bias and making sure that the right science gets out to the right people at the right time. And maybe that comes from a perspective of working at the interface of science and business, but the main thing is just to keep publishing and to get information out there so we can utilize it in meaningful ways. As for the shameless self-promotion,
Not shameless.
I currently write for the Science Writers and Communicators of Canada. So if you'd like to check out my SciComm, you can dabble over to their blog. So it's swcc.com and check out some of my pieces there. I cover everything from biotech topics to lab-grown meat to more recently the neurochemistry of relationships and COVID. So you can find me on Twitter at MIRNADA. Or add me on LinkedIn or Instagram, which is alt endings. So, and definitely check out Science Networkers and would love to see some of your fan base join us for future events.
Nice. And it's open to, you know, anyone could just join and be a part of those sorts of events that you're planning.
Yeah, anyone. We have attendees from New Delhi to New Zealand and everyone cool. from artists to graduate students. So feel free to join the conversation.
Awesome. So I always appreciate, you know, being my first interview. this podcast is small now, but I hope to, you know, make it grow and talk about topics like these. I think it's important for not just the general public, but also academics to start thinking about these things as they start, or even if they're in the middle of their academic careers or scientific careers, just so that it's, you know, they're aware of the processes, they're aware of, you know, the environment, the flaws of the environment, and hopefully we can find improvements to fix those issues.
Yeah, I agree. It was an honor to be your first guest.
Yes, awesome. Okay, so thanks everyone for listening, and don't forget to follow Miranda on her Twitter or Instagram pages.
Thanks for listening to this special mid-season episode of MetaForgeons. Remember to rate and subscribe for more episodes, and to follow the podcast on Instagram for updates on the next draw coming on the 20th episode. But until then, stay skeptical but curious.